This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. The official commission tasked with finding the root causes of the financial crisis issued not one but three reports today. All of the Democratic appointees on the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission backed its official report, but the Republican appointees produced two separate dissents. NPR's John Idstey has the story.
The commission, which was mandated by Congress, spent a year investigating the meltdown. It examined over a million pages of material, interviewed more than 700 people, and held 19 public hearings. Chairman Phil Angelides kicked off the commission's news conference.
This financial crisis could have been avoided. Let us be clear. This calamity was the result of human action, inaction, and misjudgment.
Angelides and other Democratic members of the commission went on to catalog the failures of Wall Street titans and government policymakers and regulators.
This report documents specific instances where leaders did not take action to stamp out smoldering threats that eventually led to financial crisis.
And the commission names names. It points out that just before Bear Stearns collapsed, Securities and Exchange Commission Chairman Christopher Cox expressed comfort about the capital cushions at Wall Street firms. It reminds us that Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke and then Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson reassured the public that the turmoil in the subprime mortgage market could be contained. But the stage for the crisis was set in the two preceding decades, according to the commission, as belief in the self-correcting nature of markets and the ability of financial firms to police themselves became widely accepted. Here's commission member John Thompson, who's chairman of Symantec.
This misplaced confidence in deregulation of a highly competitive industry was championed by the former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan and others, and supported by successive administrations and Congresses.
But while the Democrats on the commission believed that inadequate government regulation was a major cause of the crisis, Republican dissenter Peter Wallison, a former Reagan administration official, disagrees. Wallison, now at the American Enterprise Institute, argues government activism in the housing market caused the problem. He says any serious analysis of the crisis needs to focus on the fundamental issue: subprime mortgages that defaulted by the millions.
All of these very weak mortgages were stuffed into our financial system because of government policy.
Wallison argues that the government's affordable housing policies required financial institutions to make a high percentage of loans to financially challenged borrowers. By 2008, he says, half the mortgages in the system were questionable.
That was completely ignored by the commission, even though that information was provided to them.
Three other Republicans on the commission cited different reasons in their dissent. They argue that the global nature of the crisis undercuts the notion that U.S. government housing policy or lack of regulation caused the crisis. With a major overhaul of financial regulation already signed into law, the commissioners faced questions about whether their efforts would have much effect. They argued there's still lots of room for reform. The commission's work may also provide business for the courts. Angelides says it has made several referrals to legal authorities for investigation. The commission's many documents and interviews will also provide journalists and historians with material. Here's one example. In his interview with the commission, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke said at one point during the crisis, 12 of the 13 most important financial firms in the country were at risk of failure. John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. One of the nation's premier historically black universities is revamping its academic offerings. Howard University plans to reduce the number of majors and graduate programs. Among those on the chopping block, classics and African studies. An official decision is expected any day now, and some students and faculty aren't happy. NPR's Alex Kellogg reports.
Howard University has offered German classes since 1875. The university has had a German major since the 1940s. That's longer than some majority white schools. But that may soon change. And for good reason, university leaders say. After all, Howard has just one German major left.
My name is Ebony Denise Mingo. I am a sophomore, and I'm from Lexington, South Carolina, and I'm 19 years old.
Mingo spoke as she was rushing across Howard's campus here in the nation's capital to her next class.
I think it's a bad idea for them to cut the language, but they need to do more within Howard to spike the interest of the students to want to study German.
She says she fell in love with Germany when she traveled there as a kid. She's now in German 4. Howard is expected to cut old world language majors such as Russian as well. Other possible cuts? The classics and philosophy. Students will still be able to take courses such as African American philosophy and slavery in the ancient world, but that doesn't satisfy the university's critics. They say a premier black college like Howard plays a special role. For example, Howard has one of the only freestanding philosophy departments at a historically black college. So critics argue a cut there would be a big loss. University President Sidney Rabot disagrees.
Part of this is also carving out territory for Howard University where we are the best of kind in certain areas. Just like if you go to University of Michigan or you go to Harvard or if you go to Columbia or if you go to Stanford.
Howard's famous alums include Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, actor Ozzie Davis, and black radical Stokely Carmichael. The university was founded just after the end of the Civil War. It started as a seminary for African-American clergymen. Today, it has 171 academic majors. That's a huge number for a university with only around 10,500 students. The plan is to cut 20 undergraduate degree programs and at least as many graduate programs.
And it will also allow us to enhance the overall quality of our academic program so that we're sure that we're nationally competitive.
Howard's Board of Trustees is expected to make a final decision on the president's recommendations this weekend. The big lightning rod, cutting the African Studies major. Critics say that would send the wrong message. In fact, the classes remain popular, even if the major isn't. There are just a half dozen students pursuing African Studies right now. Professor Mbai Cham is the chair of the department. He points out that Howard pioneered the idea that such disciplines are vital.
I don't think Howard can afford to retreat totally from that legacy. I guess the question is, how do you move forward?
President Rabot says Howard's future is in areas of growing interest. The university plans to offer more classes in popular languages, Swahili and Chinese, for example.
我爸爸,我妈妈,我弟弟,我妹妹,我先生和我.
My name is Olivia Ford. I am 18 years old. I am from Chicago, Illinois, and I am a freshman at Howard University.
Ford was surprised when she arrived last fall to find Howard didn't have a Chinese major. She's happy they'll likely have one before she graduates.
And I think it's really good that they're making changes kind of to adapt to future student interest.
Howard graduates more black doctors, engineers, and PhDs than virtually any other institution of higher learning in the country, even though just 10% of black students currently attend a historically black college. But like many universities, Howard's endowment has shrunk in recent years. While President Rabot insists these changes aren't driven by finances, he says that to remain competitive, Howard must shift resources to where they are needed most. Alex Kellogg, NPR News, Washington.
And finally today, legions of film stars have temporarily ditched the balmy weather of Hollywood to shiver in style in Park City, Utah, at this year's Sundance Film Festival. The event wraps up this weekend. Festival organizers boasted this week that more than a dozen Oscar nominations went to films that received substantial support from the Sundance Institute or the Sundance Festival itself. Here with us to talk about what's hot in the snow and cold of this year's Sundance is Wesley Mars. He's a film critic for the Boston Globe. Wesley, welcome back. We'll try to tamp down our rage and envy.
Please don't.
That
please.
You got to hang with the stars like Jennifer Hudson and Susan Sarandon and Kerry Washington. That you were hanging.
Well, I got to tell you, I don't know where they were. I go there and I work. And one of the things about this year is that there's a much greater emphasis on the quality of the films as opposed to the stars that have come to see them or to like promote them. People are talking about the movies. And you just feel like they're trying to get back to something that is very essential about this festival. It feels like they're waking up again, and it's very exciting.
So tell us about a couple of the films that excited you at Sundance.
Well, I mean, I saw a number of films I really, really liked this year, more than I have in a while. And one of the ones that grabbed me was the opening night movie. It's called Pariah. It's about a 17-year-old lesbian who's trying to figure out not so much how to tell her parents she's gay, but exactly what kind of lesbian and black woman she wants to be. And it's both refreshing and a bit of a shock to see a woman, a young black woman, trying to make her sexuality her own in a way that falls outside of the way it's been defined by the groups that she belongs to.
Okay, hold on a second. Let's just play a short clip. And I just want to mention Spike Lee is the executive producer of the film, which is interesting because, you know, some critics have not appreciated the way they feel he has portrayed African-American women and their sexuality. So here is a short clip from Pariah.
How I dress has nothing to do with how I feel.
What?
Just because I don't bag my jeans and rock beaters all the time, does that make me fake?
I never told you to dress any kind of way.
Now listen, you tell me the truth.
You already know.
Well, so there it is. So was there a breakout?
I just got a little chill remembering that scene in that movie. The director is a woman named Dee Reese. She's a newcomer. It's her first feature. This is based on a short that was also at the festival a couple of years ago. And she is just so perceptive about how people relate to each other, how people express themselves. It feels true. It feels like, I mean, I know these people. I've been to this part of Brooklyn. And the Kim Wayans, the comedian, plays her mother, a woman who's very aloof and not wanting to admit the fact that that her daughter's gay. And the father is a cop who is very close to the daughter, but also doesn't really want to know.
Now, another film that got your attention is also a family, kind of centered on the dynamics of a family. And it's called Gun Hill Road, which New Yorkers will recognize is in the Bronx. Mm-hmm. And it's about a family that's trying to readjust after the father returns from prison. Here's a clip.
What are you doing, Angie?
I'm getting ready for bed.
Don't you miss me?
Nikki, please, not now. I'm tired.
Yeah, what are you tired from?
Life.
Life, huh? I thought you was tired from going with that new boyfriend of yours.
What are you talking about? I don't got no boyfriend.
No?
No, what are you, deaf?
Don't lie to me, Angie. Ain't f***ing stupid!
And that was Esai Morales as Enrique and Judy Reyes as Angela in Gun Hill Road. And the lives of people who are connected to prison crime, so forth, have been subjects of films before. What do you think makes this film distinct?
What makes this film distinctive is that the son that these two characters have is in the process of changing his gender. He's becoming a woman, and the Esai Morales character has come from prison after 3 years of being there. His son is turned into his son is becoming a different person. He recognizes that, but does not recognize his son. And so there's this really interesting tension between this very macho guy who I can only imagine what he experienced in prison. His son's becoming this sort of worst case scenario for his paternity. You know, one of the things that I was heartened by in this, both the festival this year and watching these two movies and a handful of others, is just that, you know, it reminds you that the world is bigger than what we've often been given in films.
We're talking with Boston Globe film critic Wesley Morris about the Sundance Film Festival. But before we let you go, Wesley, there's also a documentary that you told us caught your eye. This one is called The Interrupters, and it follows a group of men in Chicago who literally interrupt crime. We've actually featured some of the people on this program. There's some strong language, as you would imagine, in the film. We've tried to obscure some of it while trying to keep the flavor of what you're going to hear, but I'm just going to warn people that all of it may not be obscured. I'll just play a short clip, and we can talk about it.
When I let loose, goddamn, they going to know. Shouldn't have crossed me.
But still, though, man, you got to try to leave that alone, though, man.
I ain't even shit alone until I get these motherfuckers.
But you was locked up before for the same shit, though.
Man, I've been locked up 15 years in my life. What that mean?
We just try to offer you options and solutions to the problem.
Man.
This shit.
A problem. A solution.
Yeah, it's a rough one. But anytime you got a person who will stay there and talk with you, you got a chance of working it out with them.
Well, that's interesting. What about it? Tell us more, Wesley. What did you think?
I mean, it's so interesting listening to those clips. I mean, this Steve James made this film. He's the director of Hoop Dreams. I find his commitment to his subject slightly problematic because I think it crosses certain ethical boundaries. And I think here his MO is to just stand back and observe the way this task force, Ceasefire, goes about preventing gang violence. You know, they don't want to stop the gangs. They just want to stop the murders. And what you realize watching this is that there's a way in which what they're doing is kind of inadequate. I mean, we do see in the film that it stops some things from happening, but it raises so many other questions about how you give poor black Americans self-esteem when they've institutionally had it taken away from them. And I think one of the things that the movie uncovers is that there needs to be a psychological and emotional and social way of getting at the root of the problem as well.
Wesley Morris is a film critic for the Boston Globe. He's just back from Park City, Utah at the Sundance Film Festival, and he joined us from Boston. Wesley, thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
And that's our program for today. Tell Me More is produced by Bracton Booker, Bridget Deshagas, Grant Clark, Lori Grant, Lee Hill, Sanaj Meshkinpour, Veronica Miller, Emily Oxenschlager, and Amy Ta. Our editor is Kyle McKinnon. Our directors this week are Arjun Hutchins and Monica Evstatieva. Our senior producer is Alicia Montgomery. Our intern is Rachel Otwell. Our technical director is Kimberly Jones. She had a hand this week from Neil Tebolt. Our theme music was composed by Underdog Entertainment with additional arrangements by Ian Honeyman. The supervising senior editor is Portia Robertson-Migas. The executive producer is Tashima Walker. And remember, to tell us more, you can always go to npr.org and find us under the Programs tab. You can also follow us on Twitter. Just look for Tell Me More NPR. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more tomorrow.